I very much admired the way, in last month's lectures, Professors Leith and Hewson managed to merely talk to you. But I have no fancy tables or charts, and I'm a bit of an evidence nerd. So I'll be reading a paper, and besides, you know that the real reason you came out on this bloody cold night in February was to hear me read passages of Virginia Woolf to you. Virginia Woolf's first three experimental novels, Jacob's Room, Mrs. Dalloway, and To the Lighthouse, written between 1920 and 1927, are among her most autobiographical. Yet, as the very word experimental suggests, in each of them, Woolf undertakes formal innovations that led her to feel she had found her individual voice, her method. After Leonard Woolf finished reading a draft of Jacob's Room, Woolf wrote in her diary that, quote, "There's no doubt in my mind that I have found out how to begin, at 40, to say something in my own voice, and that interests me so." Woolf's transformation of this autobiographical material was not limited to formal experiment, however. In each case, she moved the original time frame so that the events of the novels include the Great War. A shift, I will argue, suggests that she saw the effects of the war as integral to the changed world she occupied and to the way she thought about that world. I will also argue that the epistemological and psychological effects of the war shaped her aesthetic practice of fragmenting the narrative arc, of fracturing narration, text, and character, of questioning the very discourse of the novel in an attempt to understand and represent the war's influence on an early 20th century worldview. In turn, these formal strategies create for the reader the aesthetic and affective experience of such fragmentation and prompt the reader's mental reflection upon the post-war epistemological shift inherent in Woolf's practice. There are three theoretical principles that inform my reading of Woolf's formal strategies and allow me to draw the conclusion that her disruptions of a reader's formal expectations are a response to the worldview that was intended upon the First World War. The first of these is Dennis Donahue's learned discussion of form in Speaking of Beauty. Donahue sees form as essentially antinomian, a structure of values that stands aside from the official versions of reality and goes its own way. Form, in making the distinction between what merely exists and the work of art, is in effect the very thing that makes art art, requiring of the reader or viewer or listener something more than attention to literal content. For Donahue, this integral function of form explains, quote, why literature cannot be reduced to the journalism of themes or the commonplaces of social practice. Works of literature are forms of composition rather than forms of designation. Drawing on Donahue's observations, I liken form to a meta-language that requires the reader's engagement with the questions that form raises. Why, in Jacob's Room, gesture toward a building's Roman and thwart the reader's expectations? Why write a novel like To the Lighthouse that almost exhaustively gives the reader access to the consciousness of a handful of characters on two single days, 10 years apart, and then separate these 2 days with a brief philosophical meditation on the nature of time and change, and so minimalize the significance of those richly portrayed characters that their deaths become merely bracketed statements? The second assumption, which flies in the face of late 20th century deconstruction and new historicism, is the recognition of the new formalists that form constitutes historical evidence. Frustrated by deconstructionists' attack on the integrity of the text and by the tendency of new historicists to treat artworks as bundles of historical and cultural content, new formalism focuses on form's potential to create affect in the reader, establishing the conditions of possibility for experience, textual, aesthetic, and every other kind. Richard Stryer argues that formal features of a text, matters of style, can be indices to large intellectual and cultural matters. Finally, I will argue that Wolfe's understanding of history and her aesthetic practice is similar to Hayden White's concept of the historical sublime. In keeping with Schiller's rather than Burke's view of history, White questions whether history is beautiful, meaningful, and orderly. Rather, White suggests history is a spectacle of confusion, uncertainty, and moral anarchy, that history may be as meaningless in itself as the theorists of the historical sublime thought it to be. In a similar vein, Hans Kellner questions the innocence of narrative and an imaginary plethora of facts or texts that seem transparent in their facticity. Instead, Kellner emphasizes that, quote, we cannot forget that our ways of making sense of history must emphasize the making. Wolfe's unexpected formal strategies draw such attention to themselves that they highlight the making of a fictional text. The earliest mention of Jacob's room in Wolfe's diaries comes a day after her 38th birthday on the 26th of January, 1920. Interestingly, she conceives of its form first, writing in her diary, quote, the approach will be entirely different this time. No scaffolding, scarcely a brick to be seen, all crepuscular, but the heart, the passion, humor, everything as bright as fire in the mist. As she concluded her draft, she dedicated the novel to her older brother, Julian Toby Stephen, who died of typhoid contracted on a holiday to Greece in 1906. The novel's hero, Jacob Flanders, is about 10 years younger, so that he goes up to Cambridge the year of Toby's death and dies, as his name suggests, in France during World War I. As Edward Bishop has helpfully observed about the various manuscript versions of Jacob's Room, Wolfe's tendency, as she revised, was to make Jacob less knowable, as if he is already an absence at the outset of the novel. And indeed, the first reference to him is his mother's characteristic query. Where is that tiresome little boy? I don't see him. Run and find him. Tell him to come at once. Which, of course, the curious Jacob is too busy to do. Jacob's Room is a novel that frustrates my students, who expect, consciously or not, a novel with a person's name in the title to be shaped like a building's roman in the tradition of Tom Jones or Emma. There is certainly evidence in the novel of a vestigial building's roman. Young women tend to see the enigmatic and silent Jacob in terms of heroic images, the statue of Ulysses in the British Museum, for example. Some of his rarely reported thoughts record the determination of the questing building's held to make himself a new place in society. Considering the values of one of the Cambridge dons and his conventional wife, Jacob observes, I am what I am and intend to be it, to which the narrator adds the observation, for which there will be no form in the world unless Jacob makes one for himself. Later in the novel, attempting to make a career as a public intellectual, as Wolfe's brother Toby did, Jacob works in the British Museum writing what the narrator terms incredibly dull essays upon Marlowe. And Jacob thinks, detest your own age, build a better one. A bit later, Jacob meets Fanny Elmer, an artist's model, who is immediately besotted with the beauty of young men, which seems to be set in smoke, however lustily they chase footballs or drive cricket balls, dance, run, or stride along roads. Possibly they are soon to lose it. Possibly they look into the faraway eyes of heroes and take their station among us half contemptuously. Significantly, Jacob suggests that Fanny needs to read Fielding, and she picks up Tom Jones in one of London's many secondhand bookstores. When Jacob leaves for the Building Held's episode of Continental Education, Fanny blames her abandonment on the building's roman. Fanny thought it all came from Tom Jones. He could go alone with a book in his pocket and watch the Badgers. He would take a train at 8:30 and walk all night. He saw fireflies and brought back glowworms in pillboxes. It all came from Tom Jones, and he would go to Greece with a book in his pocket and forget her. To assuage my students' frustration with chapters made as much of fragments from Jacob's familial, social, or geographical milieu as of Jacob's thoughts, loves, or adventures, I point out the fact that the novel is called Jacob's Room, that at its center is a Jacob-shaped hole that is analogous to his rooms in Cambridge or his flat in London, as if he is an absence from the novel's outset, an absence already present in Fanny's sense that however lustily Jacob's generation chases balls or strides along roads, their faraway look suggests they take their station among us, half contemptuously aware that they are about to lose something precious. The novel also makes use of several repetitions that might be seen as a formal attempt to hold the rather fragmentary text together. But this strategy gestures towards absence rather than closure, toward a comment upon historical change rather than a suggestion of stasis. In the simpler of these two experiences of Jacob's empty room are described in exactly the same words. Earlier in the novel, Wolfe's narrator goes up the stairs to see if Jacob is in his Cambridge rooms. Wolfe has oddly two narrators in this novel. One of them lives in the novel, and the other one is a classic omniscient narrator. This is the one that lives in the novel. He isn't. Rather, quote, listless is the air in an empty room, just swelling the curtain, the flowers in the jar shift. One fiber in the wicker armchair creaks, though no one sits there. That image, one we have all experienced in an empty room, which somehow keeps the energy and presence of a strong personality, even when he or she is gone, powerfully evokes the presence of absence. In the empty room, the narrator finds an essay on Jacob's table, headed by a query that suggests a reference to Carlyle's heroes and hero worships. Does history consist of the biographies of great men? One suspects, given Jacob's rather confident sense of self and the Cambridge confidence in masculinity, that he is working on proving the answer is yes. In the novel's final scene, that same description of a swelling curtain, shifting flowers, creaking chair is used word for word. Here, Jacob's closest friend, Bonamy, has come to help Jacob's mother clean out his room after his death in the war. Bonamy, rather than the narrator, glances down at Jacob's desk, noticing the papers, and once again asks a question. He left everything just as it was, nothing arranged, all his letters strewn about for anyone to read. What did he expect? Did he think he would come back? The two identical descriptions of absence urge us to see the implicit difference between the two queries about how history works, and to tie that sense to the beautiful and the sublime readings of history. If history really were composed of the biographies of great men, it would be manageable, comprehensible, orderly, an assumption that English generals took to the trenches. As the generals learned later, rather than sooner, history is chaotic. It takes place on an unimaginably and inconceivably large scale. It is, in short, sublime. Wolfe's rhetorical questions and repetition reveal that fact. The more complicated repetition also queries history, this time asking how historical events have an impact on our worldviews and the author's aesthetics. As a young Jacob takes the train up to Cambridge, he joins the compartment of Mrs. Norman, an elderly woman who is at first frightened of him. Taking note of his socks, loose, of tie, shabby, she once more reached his face. She dwelt upon his mouth. The lips were shut. The eyes bent down since he was reading. always firm, yet youthful, indifferent, unconscious. That's for knocking one down. The omniscient narrator here takes what she terms Mrs. Norman's report and concludes, nobody sees anyone as he is, let alone an elderly lady sitting opposite a strange young man in a railway carriage. They see a hole. They see all sorts of things. They see themselves. It is no use trying to sum people up. One must follow hints, not exactly what is said, nor entirely what is done. Similarly, just as Jacob meets Sandra Wentworth Williams, who will become his married lover, the narrator queries her impression of him, concluding, quote, it is no use trying to sum people up. One must follow hints, not exactly what is said, nor yet entirely what is done. There is also the highly respectable opinion that character mongering is much overdone nowadays. Forgive me if I now quote extensively, for it is from this long passage that my paper takes its title. It is also this passage that implicitly, through juxtaposition, connects the war with Wolfe's sense that both our perceptions about character and the form of the novel have been utterly transformed. So we are driven back to see what the other side means, the men in clubs and cabinets, when they say that character drawing is a frivolous fireside art, a matter of pins and needles, exquisite outlines and closing vacancy, flourishes and mirrors crawls. Battleships ray out over the North Sea, keeping their stations accurately apart. At a given signal, all the guns are trained on a target which flames into splinters. With equal nonchalance, a dozen young men in the prime of life descend with composed faces into the depths of the sea, and there, impassively, though with perfect mastery of machinery, suffocate uncomplainingly together. Like blocks of tin soldiers, the army covers the cornfield, moves up the hillside, stops, reels slightly this way and that, and falls flat. Save that, through field glasses, it can be seen that one or two pieces still agitate up and down like fragments of broken matchstick. These actions, together with the incessant commerce of banks, laboratories, chancelleries, and houses of business, are the strokes which oar the world forward, they say. It is thus they live, we live, they say, driven by an unseizable force. They say that the novelists never catch it, that it goes hurtling through their nets and leaves them torn to ribbons. Just as character drawing and the novel are torn to ribbons, so are the historical events literature might engage with, characterized by arbitrariness and challenge to meaning. Despite the young men's perfect mastery of machinery, they suffocate. The orderly attack that the generals might expect to see through their field glasses, like the order we might expect from history, is instead a deadly chaos likened to fragments of broken matchsticks. Change and chaos and darkness fall upon Europe. The narrator observes that, quote, now the agitation of the air covered a racing star. Now it was dark. Now one after another, lights were extinguished. Now great towns, Paris, Constantinople, London, were black as strewn rocks. An allusion to Sir Edward Grey's statement made in August 1914. The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. It is not enough, however, for the narrator to simply tell us that civilization is challenged by the unpredictable and uncontrollable events of the war. The millions of casualties and injuries have in themselves been pretty convincing. But if we need to feel this truth ricochet through culture, if we need to query the narrative provided by the generals and the politicians, the forms of art that provide us with a way of being curious about the young man who is barely a presence at the beginning of a novel, provide us with an elegiac experience. Wolfe's sense of history's sublimity meets her quest for a new appropriate form and provides us with this frustrating, powerful novel that challenges our sense that we know our culture intimately and that we know how to read it. A similar sense of the cult, the historical sublime influences the form of To the Lighthouse, where Wolfe again alludes to Gray's announcement, simply observing at the beginning of the novel's experimental middle section, one by one, the lamps were all extinguished. As she worked on her new, by Virginia Woolf, a what? Elegy? Finding the right form was an important part of her conception. She was worried about the possible sentimentality of this highly autobiographical novel that was, quote, to have father's character done complete in it, and mother's, and St. Ives, and childhood, and all the usual things I try to put in, life, death, etc. Concerned about how the depiction of father and mother and child in the garden, the death, the sails of the lighthouse, would be simply a saccharine reflection of the past, she resolved, quote, to enrich it in all sorts of ways, thicken it, give it branches and roots, by including this impersonal thing which I'm dared to do by my friends, the flight of time and the consequent break of unity in my design. A second but related way she avoids the sentimental is to move the narrative forward 14 years, so its time frame brackets the war, beginning in 1909 and ending in 1919, rather than setting the novel in 1895, the year of her mother's death that ended the family visits to Cornwall. To the Lighthouse is an indisputable contribution to the modernist conversation about aesthetics and form. Wolfe's inclusion of painter Lily Briscoe among the house guests affords Wolfe the opportunity of reflecting, in Lily's voice, on the Impressionist and Post-Impressionist aesthetics that had been introduced to England by Roger Fry in his exhibition of artists like Manet, Cezanne, and Picasso at the Grafton Galleries in 1910. Lily's aesthetic and her focus on the form of her painting reflect Fry's thought as it was articulated in the collection of his early essays, Vision and Design, except that, in cheeky feminist mode, Wolfe has given Fry's aesthetic principles to Lily the year before Fry would write about them. One of Fry's formal principles was that unity in a painting depended upon, quote, a balance of the attractions of the eye about the central line of the picture. The result of this balance of attractions is that the eye rests willingly within the bounds of the picture, end quote. Wolfe knew she was borrowing this principle. When she answered Fry's letter praising her novel, she told him about the time passes section. One has to have a central line down the middle of the book to hold the design together. The form of Lily's final vision, which is created when she draws a central line down the middle of her canvas, echoes the form of the novel as a whole. There is a drawing in the original holograph of To the Lighthouse where Wolfe represents her work as two blocks joined by a corridor. The two blocks are the sections called the window and the lighthouse. Set in 1909, the window, which takes up the novel's first 100 pages, represents a single day spent on the island of Skye by the Ramsay family and their house guests in September. Like most of us on the autumnal days at the end of a holiday, the characters experience the weather, the light, the conversation, with an unusual intensity that encourages reflection. Set 10 years later, the 53 pages of The Lighthouse record the thoughts of Lily as she spends the day painting, and of Mr. Ramsay and his son James and daughter Cam as they make their voyage to the lighthouse that had been planned in the window, but that was aborted by bad weather. But the corridor of time passes section of the novel, this impersonal thing that will break the unity in my design, and which includes the war, challenges our most basic assumptions about novelistic discourse. Even if To the Lighthouse were the first novel we had ever read, I wouldn't recommend it, influenced by the emphasis in the first 100 pages on characters' thoughts, experiences, and recollections, We might be forgiven if we assume that the focus of the modernist novel is characters doing things and contemplating the universe and querying society. But the characters we have come to know so well that do figure in The Time Passes do so only in brief statements about deaths and marriages that are enclosed in square brackets that underscore their unimportance in this section of the novel. The death of Mrs. Ramsay, which parallels the death of Wolfe's own mother, a death which precipitated Wolfe's first encounter with mental illness, is bracketed and simply reads, "Mr. Ramsay, stumbling along the passage, stretched his arms out one dark morning, but Mrs. Ramsay having died rather suddenly the night before, they remained empty." Andrew's death as a young soldier is also in brackets. A shell exploded. 20 or 30 young men were blown up in France, among them Andrew Ramsay, whose death, mercifully, was instantaneous. The only active forces here are two cleaning men who valiantly attempt and fail to return the house to its condition before the war. The mere 17 pages of Time Passes record, like a camera taking time-lapse photographs whose battery dies and then is replaced from time to time, fragments of another world altogether over the 10 years that separate the 2 days. Represented on this indifferent, disengaged scale, the passage of time necessitates an impersonal approach to narrative. Rather than following the characters we knew so intimately through the novel's first 100 pages, characters with names, histories, and desires, we follow an anonymous character often referred to as the sleeper, the mystic, or the visionary. This figure has questions he or she feels might be answered by a walk along a beach, questions that in the 19th century might have brought into being an entire novel by George Eliot or Henry James. While the questions are urgent, answers are not forthcoming. Quote, "Also the sea tosses itself and breaks itself, and should any sleeper, fancying that he might find on the beach an answer to his doubts, a sharer in his solitude, throw off his bedclothes and go down by himself to walk on the sand, no image with semblance of serving a divine promptitude comes readily to hand, bringing the night to order and making the world reflect the compass of the soul." This figure asks, what am I? What is this? In spite of the plethora of questions and the seeming lack of meaningful order, the mystic concludes that good triumphs, happiness prevails, order rules. One August night, however, this uneasy truce between questioning and optimism is broken. There came later in the summer ominous sounds like the measured blows of hammers dulled on felt, which, with their repeated shocks, still further cracked the teacups. Now and again some glass tinkled in the cupboard as if a giant voice had shrieked so loud in its agony that tumblers stood inside a cupboard vibrated too. There was the silent apparition of an ashen-colored ship, for instance. Come, gone. There was a purplish stain upon the bland surface of the sea as if something had boiled and bled invisibly beneath. This intrusion into a scene calculated to stir the most sublime reflections and lead to the most comfortable conclusions stayed their pacing. It was difficult, blandly, to overlook them, to abolish their significance in the landscape, difficult to continue as one walked by the sea to marvel how beauty outside mirrored beauty within. As in Jacob's room, repetition tends not toward comfort or pattern or meaning, but toward a dissolution. Just as the time passes breaks the unity of a project, the war breaks into the visionary's relentless but not gloomy questioning to challenge some of the philosophical foundations of art and history. The sublime is stayed, beauty questioned. If there is a ground note in the chorus of voices that makes up to the lighthouse, or a single thread one can pick out at the dense fabric of the character's perceptions, it is the fact that, quote, nothing was simply one thing, end quote. This is what young James discovers in the closing pages of the novel as he, his sister, and his father near the lighthouse. In an epiphanic moment that combines James's observations about the world with his anger about his father's difficult and demanding manner, James thinks of how he conceived of the lighthouse 10 years before when they planned to make this journey, but the weather intervened. Then, quote, the lighthouse was a silvery, misty-looking tower with a yellow eye that opened suddenly and softly in the evening. But as they draw closer, he could see the whitewashed rocks, the tower, stark and straight. He could see that it was barred with black and white. He could see windows in it. He could even see washing spread on the rocks to dry. End quote. In this juxtaposition of distant ideal and the quotidian, we too recognize that nothing was simply one thing. The reader who arrives at this point also has a kind of epiphany. Many of the novel's concerns finally become clear. We might recall passages like Mrs. Ramsay's description of the very tactless, abrupt, cynical young Charles Tansley, one of Mr. Ramsay's necessary acolytes. Yet he looked so desolate, yet she would feel relieved when he went. Yet she could see that he was better treated tomorrow. Yet he was admirable with her husband. Yet his manner certainly wanted improving. Yet she liked his laugh. Or one might recall Lily's puzzle. How then did it all work out, all this? How did one judge people, think of them? How did one add up this and that and conclude that it was liking one felt or disliking? While James is having his epiphany, the painter Lily Briscoe is having her vision, putting down the middle of her canvas the single line that echoes the corridor down the middle of the novel. Does the line unify or divide? Can we even have one without the other? For if we are going to assert a unity in the world, must we not have a vision and apprehension of its divisions, its disconnections? The line Roger Fry conceived of, which encourages the eye to rest willingly within the bounds of the picture, here becomes a line that gestures both inwardly to the text in James's personal epiphany, and outward to context in the Time Passes section, which appeals to the offstage violence of the war for a shift in our way of understanding the world and the sublimity of the war's challenge to our worldview. We must admit that it is now difficult, continue, as one walked by the sea, to marvel how beauty outside mirrored beauty. I'm hesitant to say that World War I alone counts for Wolfe's aesthetic practice, because nothing is simple. In fact, nothing was simply one thing. The war is not the only context that impinges on Wolfe's experimental practice. In 1922, Percy Lubbock wrote The Craft of Fiction, which Wolfe herself acknowledged was one of the first studies to look at the novel as if it were an art, not a kind of glorified journalism. The novel got self-conscious about a lot of things, including form. As well, beginning in about 1910, a whole raft of questions about the relationship between life and art are launched by Wolfe's brother-in-law, Clive Bell, questions that were posed and answered in a variety of ways, questions that come back to this issue of form. For Bell, significant form was the only thing that was important. For Wolfe's fellow writer, E.M. Forster, form got in the way of telling a story. At the same time, however, I would like to argue that Wolfe conceived of post-war modernism as an aesthetics, one that found and or created rhetorical strategies that depended on the reader's engagement with the meta-language of form, and so led the reader directly to the experience of modernity, into the experience of interpretation, confusion, complexity, contradictoriness, meaning urged, not made, formally rather than discursively. Wolf manages to balance the beautiful and the sublime in the beauty of the prose, the formal beauties of repetition, of shaping, of exactly the right narrative technique, with the post-war brokenness